Christian Blood, KTSA News.
Politico.com. Here's the lead. Donald Trump on Saturday said it will be a bloodbath for the United States if he doesn't win in November. And this has touched off Charlottesville Part 2. Okay, Charlottesville 2.0. Fine people. The fine people hoax. We're running that jive again. We're running that play again. Pulled it out of the playbook. This was at a Trump rally in Ohio. He's rallying because tomorrow is primary day in Ohio. He doesn't need it, but there's a Republican Senate primary in Ohio and some other races. So anyway, I'm going to play for you, and it's a little long, but I want you to hear it in context, what he said, and then we'll talk about it. Cut number one.
Mexico has taken over a period of 30 years, 34% of the automobile manufacturing business in our country. Think of it. Went to Mexico. China now is building a couple of massive plants where they're going to build the cars in Mexico and think that they're going to sell those cars into the United States with no tax at the border. Let me tell you something to China. If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands the way I deal, those big monster car manufacturing plants that you're building in Mexico right now, and you think you're going to get that, you're going to not hire Americans, and you're going to sell the cars to us. Now, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it. But they're not going to sell those cars. They're building massive factories.
All right, it appears very obvious that he's talking about a bloodbath for the auto industry. And why would it mean anything else? Well, it has to mean much more than that. It has to mean that Donald Trump is threatening to unleash a bloodbath if he doesn't win the election. And that is immediately where everyone went. Now, I would understand the Biden campaign going there. I mean, what have they got? They got to run on Trump. They can't run on their own guy. They can't run on their own record. We've talked about this. Their whole, you know, scheme is our opponent is so awful that you can forgive anything we've done or not done because he has to be stopped. We're the lesser of two evils. So I'll skip over the Biden campaign spinning this with disinformation, but there is no excuse for the news media. There is no excuse for misinterpreting this, getting this wrong. The whole section of the speech, the whole prelude was about the auto industry, which is a big industry in Ohio. It's very clearly what he's talking about. They didn't misunderstand him. They are intentionally lying about it. He tells the audience the American automobile industry will be a bloodbath because the Biden administration will allow Chinese cars built in Mexico to flood the market. He's right. People in the auto industry know this. It's been written about in the trades. That is what he's saying. Nancy Pelosi went on CNN and said that Trump would exact a bloodbath if he loses. This is the bloodbath hoax. And again, I get the Democrats running it, but there is no excuse for the media. However, it's pretty clear that this is something that worked before. See, when they ran the whole Charlottesville fine people hoax, they edited the tape. And so a lot of people only heard the selectively edited version of what Trump said. And to this day, I have people tell me, Jack, you're wrong. I heard it. I've heard it. And I know they heard something, but what they heard was edited. And the same thing will happen here. They will take this out of context and they will say he's threatening to unleash a bloodbath on the country if he's not elected. But there's a difference. We are not the 2017 people. There is far less credibility. There's far less willingness to lend credibility today. Today, when people hear something, their first thought is, I wonder if that's what he really said. I wonder if that's in context. I wonder if I'm hearing the whole thing. I'm not talking about never Trumpers and diehard Democrats. And, you know, look, there's lots of people on both sides that live in bubbles. But for most people, their eyes have been opened about you can't always believe the first version, the first take, the first draft of what you hear. And that's the difference between then and now. It's the same play, but we've seen it before. And just like in football, when you run that play on a team the second time and they've seen it before, the defense is different, the preparation for it is different, it's not a surprise anymore. It loses a lot of its potency. They will get away with this crap with some people, but they will not get away with it with everybody. And you're watching in real time the invention, the fabrication of the bloodbath hoax. It's all over cable today. Something else that's different, I was thinking about this today. I mean, there's a lot of things that are different in the last 6 or 7 years. But another thing that's different is, you know, Twitter, now X, has community notes. And this comment, when it gets posted, is getting community noted to death because it's a bloodbath on X. There, I'll say it. Because now people can say, hey, that's not right, or you're being disingenuous, or, and if Elon Musk didn't control Twitter, we wouldn't have the community notes feature, and we wouldn't have the real time, sort of truth guarding of this comment. And Elon Musk personally has gone after some people like Joe Scarborough from MSNBC, calling him out for posting in a way that he knows is dishonest. In fact, Joe deleted his post after being just taken apart by Elon Musk. But this is not a good look for the media. At a moment when they want to be taken seriously again, when their slogans are all about their vitality to democracy and you need them and you can't get your news from some podcaster in his guest bedroom and all this other stuff, they act like this and people are reminded of why they're listening to Joe Rogan or Tucker Carlson or talk radio or whatever podcasts or blogs or social media, you know, people you're following. This is why. Because the anchor man ain't what he used to be. And I find today that even people that don't normally defend Trump, people I know that don't really like him, are finding this ridiculous and laughable and dishonest. And it's disrespectful to you because it presumes that you're an idiot. And you'll just lean back and swallow it. I've seen people today on X that hate Trump, who have different agendas from Trump, who have different foreign policy views than Trump. And they're saying there are no standards left in the U.S. media. By the way, there was also a story in Politico about how Trump is like Hitler because he uses humor. Which, I mean, you can't make up stuff like this. But, yeah, they did a whole piece, a thought piece by a guy named Michael Cruz, who said that Trump often uses jokes and laughters to normalize his behavior, a trick used by autocrats in the past. And then it gives examples of Hitler, Mussolini, and Stalin. Those were all very funny guys. I think we all know they were real knee slappers, those three. Who thinks of humor when you think of them? Like, whatever comes to mind, I say Hitler, Stalin, Benito Mussolini. Does anyone think, yeah, they were funny? No, nobody thinks that, except Michael Cruz. So if Trump makes jokes, that normalizes him, which makes him like a dictator. I guess, you know, did Saddam Hussein, was he known for telling you know, like dad jokes and Pol Pot, Idi Amin? Did they have some good one line? Did Idi Amin have some good zingers, some good one liners? I don't know. I mean, does that mean that comedians are also kind of like despots and dictators in waiting? Look, I was noticing over the last few days, if you step back from this particular episode, which is going to be with us for a few days, and you just look at the big picture, the Trump takedown is really not working. I mean, we talked last week about the legal setbacks for Fannie Willis and the Florida documents case. People see what garbage cases these are. I mean, Willis is one step ahead of being disbarred and prosecuted for perjury. What's fascinating to me is I'm hearing people who I don't think are necessarily Republicans or who I don't think voted for Trump before. And they're calling this out. They're saying, this really stinks. I mean, this really looks bad. And it makes the country look like a banana republic. I think there's people now talking. When you read something like Spiked, which is based in Great Britain, you know, they're talking about how laughable and flimsy this entire takedown effort is. The world understands. People that aren't very political understand that this is the only way Joe Biden can hope to be reelected at this point, is to either get his opponent in jail or convince enough people, just dirty him up enough, that even if he's not actually in jail, he's on his way. You know, there were polls out there for a while that said over 50% of Americans would absolutely never consider voting for Trump. And I said to you at the time, beware of those numbers, because eventually people are going to start to think about, not just be told about, but think about the years 2017, 2018, 2019, and how well they were doing, and how relatively secure they felt. And they maybe didn't like him, but their dislike of him wasn't connected to hardship or inflation or being unable to make ends meet. Their 401k was doing well, or their IRA. And again, most people don't think in terms of red and blue and Republican and Democrat, and most people don't label themselves, but they think about, how am I doing? And so after being told, well, you hated it when he was president. Oh, okay, well, I'll never vote for him. People are starting to think about, well, what was it like? And most political candidates don't have that. They've never been president, so they can't run on that. And he can. But then they look at this takedown, this lawfare, as it's sometimes called. You don't have to be a legal expert. You don't have to be a student of all this to smell it. It stinks. And it looks tawdry. I mean, Fannie Willis is a character out of a Southern Gothic novel. She's literally guilty of the things she's accusing him of. And ridiculous. I mean, her on the witness stand with the whole, it was cash and you just got to take my word for it. That's like how a child talks when you catch a child having done something wrong. And they have no way out. They make stuff up. They talk nonsense talk. She talked like a child on the stand. You just got to believe me because I said so. I have a lot of cash because my daddy told, you know, and people see that and they see the 91 charges in the four different jurisdictions. And they think, you know, this doesn't look like the normal wheels of justice turning. This looks like a takedown. And they're seeing it. And Jonathan Turley wrote about this. He quoted the judge in the Fannie Willis decision who referred to the odor of mendacity, which is a very colorful turn of a phrase, but it's basically, it's a way of saying it stinks. And so what I've been thinking about is the Trump takedown hurting him or helping him? Is it opening people up to the idea, hey, wait a minute, maybe this guy's taking all this flack because he's over the target. Maybe I need to take a closer look. I've never seen anybody gone after like this before. I've never seen D's and R's go at it like this. So is this guy up to something I should know about? Do you think it's helping him or hurting him? Of course, it's impossible to know the final answer, but what do you think as of now? So are all the storm clouds around Trump, all the litigation, lawfare, whatever you want to call it, persecution, prosecution, is it having the net effect, do you think, of hurting him, or is it helping him? It sounds like a weird question. And of course, it's not meant to help him. But it is so evident that it is Banana Republic, tin horn stuff, that I think it's driving people away from it. I think it's repelling people rather than attracting people. I know the way it's posited as, see all this stuff we're showing you. You've got to be a hero and go out there and vote for Joe Biden in November. But because Biden is such a failed president and really falling apart right in front of us, that's already a shaky, iffy kind of play to be running. And then on top of that, you have people's memories of Trump's stable, prosperous first 3 years as president. The COVID year was a mess. And yeah, he says a lot of crazy stuff, and he says a lot of off-putting stuff. And even the speech he gave about the auto industry, he doesn't talk like any other politician we've ever heard before. And you could argue, and people have argued, well, he should be more careful and he should choose his words more carefully. But you got to remember, at this point, he's going with what he knows people expect from him. He is talking the way he knows people expect him to talk. He's not going to turn into a button-down, focus group tested politician at this point. People want this businessman to tell them what's wrong with this economy. What are we doing wrong? Why am I running out of paycheck before I run out of month? And he's telling them. He's telling them what's happening with jobs. Obama told them the jobs had to go overseas, couldn't come back. And most Democrats either say that or they lie and they say, oh, we've created 15 million new jobs. Well, no, they haven't. People are going back to work after COVID lockdowns. And a lot of the new jobs, most of them, in fact, are people working a second job. So Trump's getting in there and he's talking earthily and crustily about what he knows is true. If he knows anything, he knows this. And I think people are actually drawn to what's going on because of the lawfare. What do you think? It's almost made him somebody that voters are taking another look at. And if you're the Democrats, that's the worst thing you could be doing, but I think that's what they're doing. I think that's what they're accomplishing. I don't know where he'd be without it, but so far, I think they're helping him. The whole thing looks so contrived and ridiculous. And people that, I mean, think about it for a minute. Imagine what it takes to get people to sympathize with a guy that has his own jet. I mean, it's laughable, right? I mean, how could that happen? It's never happened. But they're doing it. They've overplayed it. They've overdone it. You know, the documents case now looks ridiculous after the Hur report. The Fannie Willis case has fallen apart. He will probably be convicted in New York, by a jury that's 90% socialist. And his poll numbers will probably go up when he is. A bloodbath. Well, if there's going to be one in November, seems to me it would come from the other side, not from Trump supporters. I'm sorry, but who was out in the streets in 2020? Trump supporters? Who was burning cities? Defacing statues? Tearing down monuments and signage and memorials? Trump voters? Who was threatening federal judges and Supreme Court justices over the abortion decision? Trump voters? Now, if we look at the places where Democrats are running the ball game, violence and crime are out of control. Right now. If you think it's bad now, do you ever think about what it will look like in November if the election doesn't go the way that leaders on the left want it to and have convinced everyone it absolutely will? It has to, or democracy's dead. Who is really setting the stage for, you know, an end times election? I would argue it's the left. I would argue that the left and only the left have demonstrated an ability to put people in the streets, attacking police officers, burning businesses. Things have gotten so bad that we have the National Guard in the New York subways. And mass transit crime is a problem in Philly and Washington, D.C. as well. They're calling for the National Guard in both of those cities. And, of course, police are supposed to deal with crime, but in all these major cities, the police are now underfunded, understaffed, demoralized as a direct result of the last 4 years. In Pittsburgh, it's just been announced that police will no longer be responding to calls that are not deemed to be in-progress emergencies. So people literally, the way people were trained from childhood to when to call the police and for what to call the police, those rules have all been changed. And if you haven't called lately, you'll find out when you do. How many restaurants have closed or closed their dining rooms because they can't control crime? Taco Bell in Oakland. How many department stores have closed? Or stores that are now putting merchandise behind glass? We are becoming a third world country, and this is while there's a Democratic president, while we're living under an election that went their way. So if theft is rampant now, if lawlessness is rampant now, if people are afraid to go places they weren't afraid to go to just a few years ago, then you tell me, and I'm not wishing for this, I'm not hopeful of this, but you tell me who would be more likely to lash out in disappointment if they don't get their way in November. We've never seen anything like this. And while all of this is going on, the people we claim to care about the most, at least with words, are suddenly a mystery to us. I'm talking about our children. The attorney general in Missouri is calling on that 15-year-old girl who bounced another girl's head on the concrete to be tried as an adult, and that girl is fighting for her life. Now, a lot of things have been said about that case, and I've refrained because I don't know a lot about it. I've just read some things. I wasn't there. I'm not one of these talk show hosts that has, you know, remote viewing like some of them seem to have. But I will say this. I see something like that, and I know that's not normal. I know there's something wrong. And we've written how many articles about the concern we have about kids and social media and body dysmorphia and the wrong influences and peer pressure and TikTok and their phones and their screens and their posture and their sense of being closed off. When we were 16, we ran out into the world. We got our driver's license. We wanted to be around other people and with other people and go places. We pulled and strained at the leash. And today, if you're raising a teenager, it's not unusual for that teenager to stay home all the time and even stay in the house all the time and even stay in their room all the time and be on their phone all the time. And you worry about it and you limit it or put controls on it, but you recognize it's a different, the brain is different. They don't want to go get a license. They're not straining at the leash like we were, which was healthy for us to do. It was good that we did that. Our parents worried and maybe didn't like it sometimes, but they knew we were meant for that. And kids today are not. We're now seeing things in our own cities that years ago would be reported in the news in the cities of foreign countries. And you would say, well, I'll never go there. Well, now you live in that country. And I'm not trying to be pessimistic, but it's hard not to wonder. I think about this a lot. I mean, there's no way to know what will happen in this election. I would feel more confident making a prediction if I trusted the voting, if I trusted the ballots, but I don't. So it's impossible for me to say what's going to happen. I only know what I think should happen if it's a fair election. But I keep thinking, and I'm sure you've thought of this too, or maybe you haven't, I don't know. How will the things I just described spike, worsen, flare up, and maybe even be given the green light if Trump wins this election? If Republicans win the Senate, they're not leaving any opening for that. They're not leaving themselves a way of conceding this election. You realize that, right? All the language, all the rhetoric about this election is that it can't end with him winning. Not, may the best man win, we're both going to make our case. He must not be allowed. That's what Pelosi said yesterday. So when you say that stuff, and it might just be window dressing, but if you say that stuff enough and people hear it enough, what are you telling people to do? Think about that. What are you telling somebody out there he or she needs to do if it goes the other way? And people are starting to, you're seeing visibly the remorse for how they voted. That's something a little different, I have to say. You know, I've done this a long time. I've watched a lot of elections. You go into an election and typically most people are looking at voting the way they voted last time, because that's what they do, or how they grew up, or what their friends do, or what their peer group does. But you're seeing a lot of, particularly with black voters and Hispanic voters, They're talking a lot about how furious they are with the illegal immigrant sort of takeover of what they see as their position in their communities and in the Democratic Party. They see it. They can't miss it. The politicians are literally replacing them right in front of them. And for a group of Americans who have been told for 50 or 60 years by the Democratic Party, we got you, you'll always be able to count on us, we're the only ones you can count on. And those same politicians are saying, we're closing your school, we're closing your community center, we're taking away your housing, and we're giving it to people that just got here, along with free money and phones. There's a discombobulation and a disruption in this election we've never seen before. So there's a lot of pots on the stove, and they're all bubbling over right now. What do you think? And that brings us back to that big question we started with. Is the takedown hurting or helping Trump's efforts at converting voters? At working on those I-would-never-vote-for-him people? Because he's definitely getting them. How many, I don't know. I'm kind of proud of what I did this weekend. I never say this. I never talk about this stuff, but it's bulk pickup time in my neighborhood. And I had this big wooden playset in the backyard. You know, the kind that has like a couple of swings and a slide and a climbing wall and a deck that you climb up onto. And it's kind of like got some A-frame supports, and it's all 4x4s, solid wood, all wood. Everything is wood except the slide and the swings. And my daughter's about to turn 19, and it's old. And it looked to me like the wood was starting to rot. It looked very weathered. So I was thinking this past week, I should just take that down and put it in the bulk pickup. And when I started working on it, I had a realization, which is that it took two people to put it up. It really would take two people to take it down. There's this big overhead beam, you know, huge thing over your head. You don't want it to fall on you. So anyway, I'm doing this alone because there's nobody. My then brother-in-law helped me put it together. And when we put it together, we each had a power drill, and we drove about 80 screws and bolts into this wood. It was a kit to build it. Well, I thought maybe my drill would reverse the screws. No, they've been in there all this time. So by hand, with a hex wrench that's like the size of your house key, you know those things, cheap pot metal, right? I'm loosening all these screws. And then the bolts. And I had to do it in a certain order so that it didn't fall on me. All I could think of was, what a way to go. This thing falls on me. First of all, I'm dead. Second of all, I'm in the backyard. Nobody can even see me. So it took about 3 hours, and got it all down, cut it up, because, you know, the bulk is supposed to be only so. And anyway, it's weird because you should only feel this sense of accomplishment when you build something. Like, I felt the way you would feel if you built a shed or put up a fence or built a table and chairs. And I was taking it apart. But I don't have the skills to build stuff. I'm like those radicals. I only know how to tear stuff down. So now I know how they feel. It felt really good. I tore it down. But I can say in my defense, I had helped put it up. So that's okay.
Well, let me say that we're all proud of you, Jack, for not
thank you, Don,
for not bothering any of us to help you.
Yeah, it wasn't the kind of thing. Yeah, it didn't rise to the level of ask somebody to come over, and yeah, no. And I just thought, you know, I could just leave it, but eventually it's going to really look bad, and you know, what's bulk pickup for, right? I mean, this is what it's for, so. Somebody took the slide. I don't know what the heck they could have done with the slide. They took that, so. I don't know.
That was a missing part to their swing set. Possibly.
Maybe, yeah, maybe theirs didn't have a slide. I don't know. But it was an interesting project. I will say power drills are a wonderful thing. But when you go to take it apart, you regret how thorough you were. You know, like, I was really driving these bastards home, you know, tightening, countersink every screw, you know. And I'm out there with the hex wrench, like, oh, why was I so anal about this? But I already know the answer, because I am. Did Donald Trump threaten the country with a bloodbath if he was not elected in November? That's what everybody is reporting. This is what he actually said, at a rally in Ohio over the weekend. Cut number one.
Mexico has taken over a period of 30 years, 34% of the automobile manufacturing business in our country. Think of it. Went to Mexico. China now is building a couple of massive plants where they're going to build the cars in Mexico and think that they're going to sell those cars into the United States with no tax at the border. Let me tell you something to China. If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands the way I deal, those big monster car manufacturing plants that you're building in Mexico right now, and you think you're going to get that, you're going to not hire Americans, and you're going to sell the cars to us. Now, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it. But they're not going to sell those cars. They're building massive factories.
Politico.com, Trump frequently paints a dark picture of the country as he lays out his case against President Joe Biden ahead of November's presidential rematch. And he often employs increasingly heightened rhetoric when addressing the felony charges he's facing in his efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election in the run-up to the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. Was the Capitol insurrection, in quotes, a bloodbath? The bloodbath I remember were the streets of American cities in the summer of 2020. And then everybody ran with it, ignoring the obvious reference, which was to the auto industry. He was merely observing what numerous journals that cover the auto industry have already predicted, that they are facing a major showdown with an increasingly energized and aggressive Chinese automotive industry. They are coming for the U.S. market. They make no secret of it. It's not like only Trump is saying it. And he's talking about what he would do as president to prevent it. Now, if the Biden campaign wants to transform this into a foot-in-mouth moment or a threat, that's one thing. That's, you know, that's beanbag. All's fair. But for people in the media, for Politico, for MSNBC, for CNN, for the New York Times and the Washington Post, to pretend they didn't know that or they don't know that is why nobody trusts them. It's why they have no credibility. In fact, the difference between now and the Charlottesville hoax was that in 2017, when they misreported and selectively edited the Charlottesville comments, there was still a measure of residual benefit of the doubt that, you know, good, respectable people gave them. I'm sure they couldn't say that if it wasn't true. I heard him say it. They played it on such and such a network. Today, people are snake-bitten. Today, when the media confronts you with an "oh, wow" quote, it's like somebody coming up to you on the street trying to sell you a Rolex. You don't go, "oh, okay, yeah, that looks like a beautiful Rolex." Your guard goes up. Even people that don't defend Trump and won't defend him realize how laughable and dishonest this is and how disrespectful it is of you. And it's the kind of rhetoric that's ruining the country itself. It's ruining our ability to talk about politics. You know, you hear people say nowadays, I've even said it, that you avoid talking politics with people when you know you disagree. Like, there are many relationships I have where we just don't go there because we very clearly disagree. Now, at one time, back in the day, it was fun to go there when you disagreed. It was, you know, it was a recreational debate. You know, I'm not going to change your mind. You're not going to change my mind. Let's mix it up a little bit. What do you got? We have ruined that, which was a very, very intrinsically American habit. We have turned politics into a no man's land. You don't dare traffic, engage, unless you're with like-minded people. That's incredibly unhealthy. As Barack Obama used to say, that's not who we are. But even people that don't like Trump's policies don't like this kind of distortion. And when you see the media, not a political campaign, not a political opponent, but the media, when you see them engage in this, it makes you question everything that they tell you. Now, remember how in the early days of COVID, the media were the delivery system for all the shoulds and shouldn'ts. You should do this, you shouldn't do that, start doing this, stop doing that, and people did. Because their local trusted anchor person or the network they always watched or the app they had on their phone, that's what it told them. When you lose that, you lose cohesiveness. Yes, a lot of what they told you was bull, but I mean, we're losing the things that we could all agree on or have some faith in. And that kind of makes me wonder about the framing and the taking down of Trump itself. Because that's another institution that people used to have faith in, the courts, the legal system. I mean, we had our lawyer jokes, but there weren't judge jokes. there weren't DA jokes, because we believed, most of us, and the more conservative you were, the more you believed it. That these were people of probity and necessity. We have to have law and order. And so we watched this moron in Fulton County, Georgia, one step ahead of being disbarred herself, giving childishly unbelievable testimony, like a kid caught with her hand in the cookie jar. And I look at this and I think this is earning him more support, or at least a second look, from patriots who don't want to see this country turned into a banana republic or more of one than it already is. And people are starting to even regret the way they voted. I want to play this for you. This was a group of Chicago voters discussing their community and how disappointed and distraught they were with what was going on. Listen to how it ends. Cut number 4.
So they bringing them in. You wonder where the money coming from. They taking it. The COVID fund that was here. Yep. That money. Yep. You talking about all the housing programs. So when people pay rents, all the rental programs, that money. All the programs that we have in the city of Chicago, they are bankrupting us. They are taking from all of these programs that we have. Yeah. And they're taking the money and they're funding the migrants. Yeah. Our taxpayers, we've already paid $32 million out of our taxes to house and take care of the migrants thus far. Now, we already know the only ones who qualify to become citizens in asylum here from the starts of the, they were here after August. They don't even qualify. But here we're going to be taking care of them for 5 to 7 years while there's paperwork floating on people's desk. And why? Send them home. Send them back. But Venezuela already said, oh, we're not taking them back.
Who did you vote for?
First of all, I have no problem with saying that I did vote for Biden because I was not voting. Okay. I did.
Okay,
but here it is.
Hold on. That was a question. Okay. You answered it, right?
Okay.
This migrant influx that we're dealing with right now, This is your fault.
Uh-oh. Okay, well, let me say, hold up. First of all,
you voted for it. How many times have you said that to yourself when you're watching the news? When you watched people like man on the street interviews in San Francisco or Chicago or New York? Do you ever think to yourself, I know I do all the time, and I know, not maliciously, not with hate in my heart, but because these are my fellow Americans, but I think to myself, you voted for this repeatedly, vehemently. You voted for it. Not only nationally, but locally. You have sentenced yourself to the prison you're living in. There was a story in the New York Post about AOC's district and how unhappy people are with the third world conditions, one of them called it. These are vibrant, diverse communities in her district, Corona, Jackson Heights, parts of Queens, that look like an open-air flea market in a third world country. And they interviewed a former Democrat turned Republican who's now running for a state assembly seat in that area. And that's what he called it, a third world open air market. You see clothes everywhere, junk everywhere, things stolen from donation bins and stores, people reselling stuff they've stolen, no taxes, no repercussions, they get a free pass. They do whatever they please, they're open about it, and they're not discreet, he told the New York Post. But you see, people have to go through the realization that this didn't just happen. They voted for it. These are the, not even, I was going to say byproducts, but not byproducts. These are the direct results of voting for socialists. This is what socialist countries look like. 210-599-5555 is the takedown helping or hurting Trump, in your opinion? Our poll question today, powered by River City Oral Surgery. Also coming up, we know that Texas is doing well. We know that the state is the recipient of a lot of people moving out of blue cities and states, but which parts of Texas are doing the best, and why isn't San Antonio one of those? Just to be fair, I think the media do sometimes tell the truth. NBC News had a story over the weekend about how President Biden is losing it over his reelection effort. The report said Biden is angry and anxious about the way things are going, about Trump leading him in the polls, that his numbers were dropping. In a private meeting at the White House in January, allies of the president had just told him that his poll numbers in Michigan and Georgia had dropped over his handling of the war between Israel and Hamas. He began to shout and swear, a lawmaker familiar with the meeting said. I guess that's why he's throwing Israel under the bus now. The polls have left him frustrated and questioning the travel and communication strategies. He doesn't think he's getting enough credit for an economy that created 15 million new jobs. Well, yeah, he didn't. He's chafing at the restraints the campaign has put on him. He wants to get out more to meet people face to face, but is upset as people are trying to protect him and keep him from the public. Convinced that if the public saw him more, he'd be doing better. Well, all right. Here's the president marking St. Patrick's Day yesterday, talking about Northern Ireland, cut number two.
Great to have you here, and it's very happy to see Northern Ireland's Executive Assembly reinstated last month. Now Northern Ireland is a fully functioning government again, and I didn't envision your colleague. Young people in Northern Ireland represent the great peace dividend of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement.
It's like somebody reciting something they have to just say. Sounds like the end of a car dealership commercial, you know? MSRP, blah, 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 blah. He told a story about some bricks, too. Listen to this, cut number three.
One of the men who helped build that was Edward Blewett, my great-great-great-grandfather. He worked in the town, brickyard. In 1828, he was paid, and they gave me a receipt, 21 pounds and 12 shillings to help supply the bricks for that cathedral. I was able to touch some of my own hands, the very bricks he made.
Yeah, I don't think his people are wrong to keep him away from the electorate. I think they're right on the money there. So NBC was correct. He is losing it. They said that, and that's true. Robert Kennedy Jr. may be close to naming a running mate, according to Mediaite on Saturday, citing a source close to the Kennedy campaign. This I cannot figure out. If this is true, I have no idea what he's doing. Robert Kennedy's running mate will be 38-year-old Nicole Shanahan, the ex-wife of Google co-founder Sergey Brin. Shanahan is a Bay Area lawyer, a longtime Democratic donor who donated to Biden's 2020 campaign, describes herself as progressive through and through, has never held political office, has never spoken out or written about any issue that we know of. Remember last week there were rumors that Kennedy was considering Aaron Rodgers or Jesse Ventura. Mediaite says RFK Jr. and Shanahan align on numerous issues. And recently Kennedy said that his running mate would be somebody incredibly attractive who the whole country would fall in love with. It's going to be somebody that will surprise people, and I think the country is going to fall in love with, he said the other day. Nicole Shanahan. I don't know. I'm going to say this probably isn't true, as it sounds ludicrous. But then again, this is 2024, so maybe better to keep an open mind about that. Steve is on the Jack Riccardi Show on KTSA. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Jack. You were talking about the lies of the Democrat Party and how that's just to be expected, par for the course, what they do. But then you were talking about the enemy media and how they're lying to us about what we're seeing happen right in front of our faces on their TV screens. We're watching this, and yet they're lying to us and telling us it's something else. And I've been telling people this for years. The reason that parents don't want their children to lie to them more than anything else is because it is an extreme, in my opinion, an extreme form of ultimate disrespect, ultimate offense. They're insulting your intelligence when they're lying to you, but yet Democrats, the supporters, they're either complicit in it and they know it's a lie, which means they are as evil as the enemy media, or they're to not know that what he said there was about the automobile industry and nothing more. But yet the enemy media tells them that it's about blood in the streets and
well, remember, though, there's one mistake in what you said, Steve. People don't see the whole thing on their screen because these networks that are lying about it, they didn't play the 1+ minute long piece I played. They just played the bloodbath. So if you only get your news from them, you are going to believe with, I guess, understandably, you're going to believe that that's what he said and that's what he meant. And you're already in a bubble. You're already only associating with like-minded people. You've already convinced yourself or been convinced he's Hitler. So it adds up for them. But to a lot more people, to a greater, far greater number of people, this stuff just doesn't add up at all anymore. And now they're inclined to always question what they hear.
Well, I've been doing that for many, 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 many years.
I know you have.
But I mean, when they are lying to you like that, when they show you something like that, as a human being, as a thinking human being, you would think they would say, well, wait a minute, that sounds crazy. He wouldn't say that. Let me check this out a little bit further.
More people are doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, well, it worked with Charlottesville, but that was 7 years ago. We've been burned many times in the last 7 years. How many times have they had to walk back? Think of the Covington Catholic kids and 100 other things like that. People have been burned. That guy selling the Rolex on the sidewalk doesn't really have a Rolex. And so that trick doesn't work like it worked 7 years ago.
They keep running the same playbook because it keeps working, Jack. I mean, they stole the election, and the Democrats, supporters, voters, the minorities who had their votes stolen from them.
Well, I said it, Steve. I don't know what's going to happen in the totality of the election. I don't know what will happen. What I do know is there are more people today who realize what you just said than 7 years ago, than 4 years ago. How many more? I don't know. Is it enough more? I don't know. But more people have been burned and more people have become, you know, jaundiced about this than were before. And the longer you keep running this jive, the fewer people there will be left to fool with it.
Well, that's why they're bringing in new folks.
There you go. There you go, Steve. Thank you. Good to hear from you. The country knows Texas is a booming state. We know that people are moving here and jobs and companies are moving here from blue states and places where either regulation or progressive politics have created an unhealthy, unwelcoming atmosphere. But it's also a fact that some parts of Texas are doing better than others. Which are the parts? Where are the jobs? Where is the growth and why? Our next guest is in a good position to break that down for us. Charles Blaine is a podcast host whose Texas Tomorrow episodes can be heard at texasscorecard.com. And Charles Blaine, it's great to welcome you to the show. I like your work, and I'm glad you had time for us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Jack. I really appreciate it. I'm glad to be here with you today.
Is there a pattern? You recently did an episode where you looked at where the jobs are, and let's talk about where they are, and is there a pattern to where they are?
Yeah, there's a loose pattern there, and what you really see is that a lot of the job growth happening in Texas isn't happening where some people would expect, you know, major cities. It's happening on kind of the outskirts of those major cities and largely in different communities that pop up in the unincorporated areas of counties or just in the suburbs outside of cities. And that's also where you're seeing a lot of the current population growth.
Mm-hmm. And there was just a piece in the Wall Street Journal the other day about how Austin's housing market has cooled down dramatically. It was at one time the hottest or one of the hottest in the country. Home prices are falling, apartment rents are falling, and they said part of it was overbuilding and part of it was a slowdown in job growth. And I think about Austin and I think about San Antonio, and these are cities that are cultivating a reputation for kind of progressive posturing. Are they starting to kind of kill the golden goose?
Yeah, they are. I mean, and they've been doing it for a while, and I think, you know, business growth outside of these major cities, and make no mistake, that's happening in Houston as well and even Dallas. And so I think the business growth that you're seeing outside of these cities is an indicator of what they're doing is not working. And so, yeah, they rode high for a while, and then the policies are starting to catch up to them, and they're going to be feeling it for years to come unless they reverse course.
And when you say communities on the outskirts of these cities, like, name some names. What are we talking about?
Yeah, so in the Houston area, we're looking at, you know, Sugar Land and Missouri City and the Woodlands. Out in, you know, Austin and San Antonio area, you're looking at kind of the New Braunfels. You're looking at San Marcos, Cedar Park, Georgetown. And then even outside of Dallas, you're looking at Plano and Frisco and McKinney and Denton, some of these smaller suburbs that still are welcoming, have a regulatory structure that's welcoming to business and are allowing people to do what they see fit with their business, and that's providing for a lot of that growth.
We hear a lot of callers to the radio station who've moved to these outskirts communities around San Antonio, and they say, look, I can have the best of both worlds. I can come into the city for the things that only big cities provide, but I can pay lower taxes, I can have less regulation, I can have more space, I can just generally breathe.
Exactly. And you're seeing a lot of these places outside of the city start to bring some of those amenities out there as well, so that it means that you even have to come into the city even less. I mean, you know, we're seeing people come in for airport trips and things that are still big, like you said, that are specific to the cities. But you're really seeing people cater to this new interest, this market that's growing up outside of the major cities and making life for them much better out there. I mean, you know, you're in the unincorporated area of the county. You don't have to worry about municipal regulation, whether it's on housing and your land use or whether it's on your business. And so it offers a certain level of freedom that you're just not finding in these cities anymore.
Do you get the sense from having looked at this that either political or business leaders in the major Texas cities, have they begun to realize this? Are they responding to this, or are they kind of sleepwalking through it, or what?
Yeah, well, they've started to realize that, unfortunately, what government does is what these elected officials are often doing, which is trying to court business back to the cities using things like tax abatements and, you know, different sort of tax incentives that would welcome them back. And the problem is that's obviously giving away money to lure a business there, but it doesn't address the underlying problem, which is the regulations that they are levying are making it unrealistic or unsustainable for these businesses to be there. Had they addressed the issue at the root cause, they wouldn't have to look at these alternative methods to lure businesses in. So they are recognizing, but unfortunately, a lot of the solutions we're seeing are just not the right solutions yet.
Yeah. And I'm curious, what got you interested in this to the point where you delved into it?
Yeah, well, outside of Texas Tomorrow, I run an organization called Urban Reform, and we focus on free market policy in cities in Texas. And so really I'm looking at things like job growth and population growth and housing affordability and identifying areas in which government is making those worse, or if they're stepping out of the way, how it's getting better. And so this is just an area of focus that we like to focus on because we think it's important, especially as we're heading into these, you know, next years and we're seeing all these people flock to Texas. Ideally, you want to keep what has made Texas successful. And so we're trying to identify those and highlight them.
Well, that's definitely important because, you know, it's easy to see where if you don't recognize patterns, Texas could go the way California went. I mean, if you go back far enough, California had all the attributes and sort of boasts after World War II that Texas has had recently, and it was the place that lured people from the East Coast and lured people from the Rust Belt, and then it went the way it went politically, culturally, socially, and you could see where we could be on that same path.
Very much so, and I think if people remain complacent, particularly in and around our big cities, we might see that happen. I mean, we're seeing different policies passed, whether, you know, they have illegal immigrant defense funds in Harris County. Dallas today was considering a proposal that would allow non-citizens to sit on boards and commissions in the city, guaranteed basic incomes popping up. So we're seeing a lot of these policies that you would typically find in places like California and New York that are being replicated here. Because that's what cities do. They see something, they like it, and then they try to replicate it. So if we are too complacent, we will start to see us go the way that California did.
Speaking of counties, I wanted to ask you, because of this phenomenon that you're describing, what would happen if there was more city-county consolidation? Wouldn't that override the differences and the advantages these outlying communities have?
Right. It certainly would, because part of the success is that, you know, Texas counties don't have ordinance making power in the way that cities do. And so when people do move out there, they're able to kind of do what they please. They might create a municipal utility district or some sort of loose structure to provide services. But generally speaking, those powers that you find in cities aren't found out there. And so if you do consolidate and give counties that power or create more municipal jurisdictions with that power, you might start to see that problem go out there as well. And people are probably going to go even further to flee from it.
The podcast we're talking about is entitled, this episode is entitled, Where Job Growth is Happening in Texas. You can find Charles Blaine's Texas Tomorrow podcasts at texasscorecard.com. And I hope you'll come back, and congratulations on this great work and this thoughtful analysis.
Well, thank you, Jack. I'd love to come back whenever you have me. I appreciate it.
We'll do that. Thank you, Charles. Appreciate it. About 40-something years ago, there was a movie called Local Hero. starring Burt Lancaster. And one of the notable things about that movie was the soundtrack was written by Mark Knopfler of Dire Straits. He has taken the theme, a song called Going Home, from that soundtrack and asked for the help of dozens and dozens of guitar legends to create a new recording of it, brand new, it just dropped on Friday, that benefits cancer charities in the U.S. and U.K. It's a who's who of the guitar. David Gilmour, Eric Clapton, Slash, Joan Jett, and many, many more appear on this version of Going Home. This is what it sounds like. And they have some other musicians on there, too. Ringo Starr plays drums along with his son, Zach Starkey. Roger Daltrey plays the harmonica. There's just a ton of people on there benefiting the Teenage Cancer Trust in the UK and Teen Cancer America. Cancer is the number one killer of teenagers and people in their early 20s. And there's also a number of guitars that have been donated by major guitar manufacturers, and those are being sold to raise additional money. All the net proceeds will go to those two cancer charities. And you can Google Going Home, Mark Knopfler, and find this song. And I hope you do. When your team is terrible, just awful, has no prospects, isn't going anywhere, you have to find something to celebrate. You have to find something to hook people in or get people excited. And I look at the Biden campaign and the bodyguard of lies in the mainstream media around it, and I think to myself, the bloodbath hoax is like a drowning man grabbing a life preserver in the turbulent ocean waters. Oh, here's something that's floating. Here's something we can hang on to. President Biden, bless his soul, is disintegrating before our eyes. His poll numbers are setting new record lows each week in multiple surveys by multiple entities. His vice president has achieved the almost impossible feat of being less popular and reassuring than he is, such that editorial writers that would normally be directing their fire against him are now suggesting she also needs to step down. By the way, if you think about it, that makes Mike Johnson the president, so that's how desperate they are. And in the midst of all this, Donald Trump has a rally in Ohio. He's giving this explication of what's coming in the auto industry based on, not by the way, Chinese competition, like the Chinese are going to do what the Japanese did 40 years ago, but Chinese machinations, Chinese intentions of undermining the U.S. auto industry. And by the way, if you know anything about the Chinese auto industry, it owes its entire existence to General Motors. It owes its entire existence to the technology sharing, design sharing, product sharing of General Motors and some of the European automakers. There was no Chinese auto industry 50 years ago. But they are coming for this market and for these companies and for American auto workers, the ones whose unions always endorse Democrats. So at his rally, Trump is laying it out for them. This is what it sounded like. Cut number one.
Mexico has taken over a period of 30 years, 30 4% of the automobile manufacturing business in our country. Think of it. Went to Mexico. China now is building a couple of massive plants where they're going to build the cars in Mexico and think that they're going to sell those cars into the United States with no tax at the border. Let me tell you something to China. If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands the way I deal, those big monster car manufacturing plants that you're building in Mexico right now, and you think you're going to get that, you're going to not hire Americans, and you're going to sell the cars to us. Now, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it. But they're not going to sell those cars. They're building massive factories.
The entire section of the comments are about the auto industry. And it will be a bloodbath for the auto industry and for people who work in it and for people who depend on it or have ancillary interest in it. And that's beyond question. In fact, what we should be asking ourselves is why aren't the other candidates also talking about that? Why isn't everyone who's seeking your vote in November warning you about that and presenting to you their plan for that? But anyway, he is, and that's what he's talking about. And anybody with, you know, a third grade education would understand that that's what he meant and that's what he's talking about. And yet, partly because their team sucks, and partly because this is sort of their jam, their brand, the people that peddled the Charlottesville hoax in 2017, the people who peddled the J6 mythology, are now selling this one. Well, he's threatening the country. He's telling people if they don't vote for him, he'll unleash a bloodbath. He'll unleash political violence. Now, I don't know about you, but all the political violence I've seen in this country in the last several years has come from the left. I'm not saying all leftists. I'm not even saying most leftists. But Antifa, BLM, Occupy Wall Street. Are you kidding me? The riots over Michael Brown and all of these hyped up, mythological, race baiting episodes, of which we've had way too many, and about which people are wising up. The people in the streets, the blood in the streets, the flames, the destruction, that didn't come from Trump voters. That didn't come from the GOP. So people are figuring out that when they hear a quote or a claim about a quote, it might be a good idea to take a deeper dive. You know, when I started doing this, 30 plus years ago, it was a rare person outside of people that work in media. It was a rare person who did that, who went for the source, who went for the raw audio or video. And it was harder to do, obviously. Today it's very easy to do, and more people are doing it. And they're doing it because over a period of time, and reluctantly, they've come to the conclusion that what is called the news is really activism. These blow-dried, good-looking gals and guys have an agenda, and it's not catching you up on the news of the day. They have a point of view, which they always did, but they now believe their point of view is so exalted that you don't deserve the raw info or the facts. You just need to know what to think about it, how to feel about it. And that's what they do. It's like cheerleaders without a game. There's no game. There's just the cheering. They might as well just come on every night and tell you how to vote and get sign off. It would only take a few minutes. But they have to sell commercials, so they got to stretch it out over a longer period. Now, I'm not against capitalism, and I'm not against advocacy, and obviously I do an opinion show, but I don't present it as come here and I'll tell you everything. You're hearing opinions, you're hearing a point of view, and you're expressing yours. But I'm impressed by how many people do their own digging. They don't take the network's word for it. They don't take my word for it. They want to know. That's what we need, and there's more of it happening. And they've done it to themselves, the news media. They threw away their status as an institution where people were like, I don't have time. Just tell me what I need to know, and then I'll watch, you know, the comedy show or whatever. They threw that away. Do you remember when, I'm going to really date myself now. Don Cooper, you'll remember this. Do you remember on the network news, toward the end of a network newscast on ABC or NBC, they would have a commentary, and it would actually say on the screen, commentary or editorial, and it would be a different person. It wouldn't be the guy that has just done the news for the last 20 minutes. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, because it separated that from the news reports.
It was very carefully staged, so you would know. Now, we've told you what happened in the world today, but we're going to give you a couple of minutes of this Eric Severide's perspective or Howard K. Smith's perspective. Yes, I am 840 years old. But that's unthinkable now. There'd be no reason to do that now. We wouldn't know when to pop that word up on the screen. It's seamless. Meanwhile, you look at the sort of takedown of Donald Trump, and you wonder to yourself, I know what they want to do. They want to make sure he doesn't get back into the presidency, but are they actually propelling him back into the presidency? Like, if the numbers are to be believed, there is a sort of transition of voters. There is a movement of voters who did not vote for him. I mean, I think it's safe to say that the people who voted for him, if they vote again, they're going to vote for him again. But this movement of voters in his direction, the voters, the kind of voters Republicans haven't had in 60 years. Now, there may be many reasons for that. The economy is a reason for that. His bluntness is a reason for that. But I think this lawfare, this takedown, the egregiousness of it, the insult to your intelligence of it, I think also plays a part. People understand they're watching somebody be railroaded. They're watching a kangaroo court. They know the only way Biden could be reelected at this point is to jail his opponent. And rather than have the effect of seeing his opponent as somebody who should be in jail, it's having the effect of souring them on the people that are trying to put him there. Don't get me wrong. The Republicans are a mess. They're an absolute mess. I think they had a pretty good week last week with the changes at the RNC, and I was buoyed by a couple of the things that I saw, but certainly not enough to make me want to sign up or anything. They're a mess. They don't really understand what's going on. They still are reluctant about a lot of what's being handed to them. But there are signs that patterns are being disrupted, voters are shifting, people are questioning the way they voted, remorseful about the way they voted. We played those voters in Chicago talking about the illegal immigrant situation. And Plus, there's sort of an American revulsion about watching somebody be railroaded. And now the bloodbath thing. Imagine you hear that he called for a bloodbath. Then you hear the whole quote. Or somebody plays it for you. Or you hear it on our show or whatever. You seek it out. What are you left thinking about the people that tried to bamboozle you? What are you left thinking about it? Donald Trump? What are you left thinking about yourself? Jeff is on the Jack Riccardi Show. Jeff, good evening.
Hey, good evening, Jack. Every time I hear you talking about advising people to question the national media and others doing the same, I think back to an afternoon in 1969. I was in the eighth grade. I had a geography teacher who today you would call a nerd. He had a certificate on the wall that he was one of the 10 fastest readers in the world. He had taken that woman's speed reading with your hand as it slides down the paper, and he was extremely good at it. And he made a comment once, you know, guys, when you hear Walter Cronkite say, and that's the way it is, April 16th, 1969, remember, that's the way he sees it. And he was a nerd, but he was ahead of his time because he was questioning then whether the national news, the godfather of the national news, was telling you all the information or just enough to get you to believe what he wanted you to believe. And I went decades before I heard people like you and others come out and publicly question, are these folks really giving us the news, or are they giving us just enough of the news so we'll believe what they want? And every time someone like you brings that up, my mind immediately goes back 50 years to that classroom and what he said. And I sure didn't appreciate him like I should have, but I sure do today.
Well, I guess it worked, though, because you remember it. I mean, it must be heartwarming for teachers in our audience to hear you say this, because you're able to remember with such clarity something you learned over, you know, over 50 years ago. And I think to your point, it's much, much more true and much, much more obvious today. Like Walter Cronkite, was so subtle that I don't think people turned off the TV and went, well, that was a pack of lies. You know, I mean, it was today, it's much easier to feel like you're being just blatantly lied to.
I mean, you didn't question Walter Cronkite any more than you questioned your dad back then. I mean, there's no way he would.
Well, you know what? It's interesting. What they used to talk about in his era, in the 50s and 60s, the so-called media bias was a corporate bias. Like, our news casts biased toward McDonnell Douglas and Boeing and General Electric and General Motors because they're the sponsors of these broadcasts. And there was this unholy alliance. GE owned NBC and so forth. That was what we used to worry about. Are they promoting war? Are they promoting defense spending? That seems like a walk in the park compared to what, you know, what they stand for and what they're promoting today.
Oh, there was a business component to that bias. And this is a cultural component. They want to change everything, least of which being who gets the best business and who doesn't. But it just, again, every time this issue comes up, and it, yeah. I know you speak about it a lot, immediately I go back and think, damn, that guy, I should have paid more attention.
Well, you were lucky to have him, yeah. About. Yeah, you were lucky to have him. And you know, you probably weren't in a position at that age to do much with it, but you are now. Jeff, great story. Thanks for sharing that. If you think about it, institutions in a society, respected commentators and anchors and government institutions and educational institutions should love that society. They should love it even though they know it's flawed or it doesn't realize its ideals. One of the most interesting things about the times we live in is that the institutions of our civilization hate our civilization. they're not promoting big corporations or promoting broad themes and ideas like being more educated or reading more or what have you, being healthier or something like that. Show me a legislature, a state legislature, a national legislature like our Congress, the EU. In a Western civilization, and I'll show you an institution that hates that civilization, that's trying to change it, that's trying to take it down, take it apart, that is disrespecting its citizens and instead serving its non-citizens. We are in the process of replacing ourselves through our elected representatives with people who are not of our country or even interested in joining our country. Because if they were interested in joining, we'd say, well, we want you. You're like us. But they're not. And it's very interesting. A survey in France a couple of years ago found that half of French Muslims believe that their religion supersedes the laws and values of France. I wonder if you took that survey in Somalian enclaves in Michigan or Minnesota, what that percentage would be. It would be high. Now, before you accuse me of being bigoted or hate-mongering, I don't hate anybody. But I think we need to understand how that happens. It happens because institutions that should represent and love the societies they serve instead hate them. And there is a kind of hatred in lying to you about the news. There is a kind of hubris about it, too. What we believe is more important than actual facts. That's quite a statement. But if you're using your channel or your newscast to just do that, isn't that what you're saying? And it's not like they're saying, well, people already know the news, so we're just giving them some perspective. I mean, a talk show is that. A talk show is opinion and commentary and give and take, but the people that supposedly give you the news are activists. Study in Finland says woke people are more likely to be unhappy, anxious, and depressed, measurably. And that sounds right, only because if you think about like Facebook or X, when you get into an argument with or a debate with a woke person, do they not seem kind of bitter and brittle? There is, I think, a correlation between sort of depression and sadness, and I don't mean clinical depression, I mean depression in the day-to-day sense. And this sort of everybody's guilty of everything mindset, you know? I mean, I'm generalizing, and I know there are bitter conservatives, and there are bitter, but I mean, and there are probably people in your belief system that fit this description that are cranky or what have you. But I'm just saying, in general, I think that's probably true. Might be worth looking into why. I guess, too, if your outlook is that things cannot get better, we live on stolen land and we're built on slavery. If things can't possibly get better, then how could you be anything but totally bummed about it? If you actually love your country and you have these ideals, at least you have something to look forward to. Like, hey, maybe we'll do better tomorrow. Maybe we'll do better next week. Maybe we'll do better next year. Maybe the next generation will be better than us. But if you believe that can't happen, yeah, it's pretty sad. It's pretty dead end. I'm in a quicksand, and I'm starting to sing. I need someone to help me, but I don't know which way to turn. I know I don't have much of a choice. I'll go March Madness time. Do you do brackets? Do you have brackets? Some people have them at work, like a group thing, or maybe you do your own. I was filling out my brackets last night. I always think I'm going to be daring and go with a couple of long shots. I always have a few kind of sort of sentimental teams that I pull for. But when I look at my brackets, I'm really very surprised. Well, you won't be surprised. Conservative. I've got UConn, UNC, Kentucky, Kansas in the Final Four. I think it'll come down to UConn and Kentucky. I think UConn will repeat as national champions. They're not my favorite team. Probably North Carolina is my favorite team. But, you kind of got to go with the tried and tested and true. But I already know that I'm wrong, because certainly in the Elite Eight, if not in the Final Four, there will be a Cinderella. So, but not in mine, so we'll see. And there's controversy about the selections for the tournament. If you haven't heard this, primarily about the Big East, which is, I think, maybe the best, certainly the second best conference in college basketball, and very underrepresented. Providence, St. John's, left out of the field of 68 teams. I think that was controversial. I was reading about, they're building a new, or not building a new, but they're remodeling the football stadium the Arizona Cardinals play in. I've been kind of following stadium news lately, because it looks like we're going to do a Spurs stadium. And they've done this big rehab of State Farm, I think it's called State Farm Stadium. And they've put in the end zone what they call casitas. They're party rooms that are glassed in with a front porch or roof deck and like rooms within the suite. And they've kind of stacked these up in one end zone. So they're like plussed up luxury suites. And the gimmick with them is, if you have one of these, you can come a lot earlier and stay a lot later. Because they think that the future is going to a sporting, for super rich people, going to a sporting event is it's a social experience, and it's a gathering, and it's a party, and it's really not oriented to the game. I wonder when the day will come that they just won't even have you won't even be able to see the field. You'll just go in the suite, and you'll just have food and drinks and, you know, beautiful women and party. And I mean, it is the Arizona Cardinals, so, you know, maybe the less attention paid to them, the better anyway. Do you know who Miriam I don't know if I'm saying her name right, Margolis is? Miriam Margolis is one of the actresses in the Harry Potter movies. I know who she is. I don't know if I'm saying her name right. But anyway, she's a supporting actress in the series of movies that have been made about the Harry Potter books. And she has made the news for what she recently said in an interview about the Harry Potter story, you know, the book series and the movies. I guess we would call it the universe, the Harry Potter universe. She says it's not for adults. Adults should not be fans. I worry about Harry Potter fans because they should be over that by now. It was 25 years ago. It's for children. I think it's just for children. She said, if your balls have dropped, then it's time to forget about it. Go on to other things, she said on an Australian morning TV show. She said the movies were wonderful, but fans need to move on. And it creeps her out that adults are still watching the movies. And so I don't really get what her deal is, because all of these fantasy series have lifelong fans. Like, I'm not particularly into the Harry Potter movies. I read the books when they came out. I kind of liked them. Wasn't liking them enough to want to follow all the movies. I've seen a couple of the movies. They're okay. They're good. But, like, I don't think there's an age limit on that. I don't even know that. I can't really think of anything that, whether it's Looney Tunes cartoons or Star Wars or Lord of the Rings. Or, I mean, to me, these are all, aren't these all ages things? You know what I watched over the weekend? Was the first Dune movie. You know, Dune 2 is out now. And before I see it, I wanted to see the first one, the one that came out about 3 years ago. Now, I read the Dune books when I was, the first time I read them, I was like 14, 15 years old. I read the trilogy, the original three books. There's a bunch of them now, but the original three Dune trilogy books, I read them when I was like 15, I think. One summer, back to back to back, and loved them. It was a big part of how I fell in love with reading itself. And then I reread them about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago, and got a lot more out of them the second time. And the thing about those books is you can experience them on many different levels. When you read them as a teenager, you relate to Paul, the main character, because he's your age. And then when you read them as an adult, you realize that the author is, he's writing about messianic stuff and about dictatorships and democracies and human nature, and there's just like all these other layers to it. And I was really interested to see what they would do with the movie. And I have to say they nailed it. The movie was phenomenal. I can't wait to see Dune 2 because the first one was so good, and I'm hoping the second one will be as good. And I think there's a third one coming. But to me, stuff like that has no. I think she's way off. I don't think there's any age limit at all. And when you love them as a young person, you often still love them as you get older, because you share them with your kids or your grandkids, or like I said, you just read them differently. And again, when I read Dune as an adult, I was seeing stuff in there about the founders and about politics and culture. And but as a 15-year-old, I was just thinking, this is about a kid my age that suddenly is ruling an empire. You know, it's very different. So I wouldn't let your balls dropping get in the way of your enjoyment of Harry Potter. I'll just leave it at that. All right, on the JR poll, powered by River City Oral Surgery, do you think the Trump takedown efforts are hurting or helping him? According to our votes today, 89% believe it's helping Trump as a candidate. 11% think it's hurting. New JR poll question tomorrow when we start live at 4 o'clock, or find it anytime at ktsa.com. I was reading a study. I'm not going to get into all the details because it's kind of weird, but they did a study at the University of Essex about smiling and how the physiological effects, you know, let a smile be your umbrella. But the weird thing was, in the study, they used a painless electrical current to manipulate people's facial muscles into a smile. I'm sorry, but that isn't a smile. You gotta like want a smile to smile. Giving people a little electric jolt. That sounds very unhappy to me. Like, hey, we're going to make you smile and then study the results. I think not. I'm opting out. All right. We're going to leave you tonight. We talked about this a little bit earlier with this new benefit record for cancer. It's a fundraiser for teen cancer in the U.S. and the U.K., spearheaded by Dire Straits' Mark Knopfler, and including the guitar work of over 50 guitar legends from the worlds of rock, R&B, jazz, and more. Here is the song called Going Home. We'll leave it with you tonight on KTSA.